la la, the banks are doing great, the stock market is up 25%, happy days are here again.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the White Star Titanic. We are not sinking, there are plenty of lifeboats. Please go back to an evening of fine dancing.
If you're happy with that, maybe you shouldn't listen to this edition of Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith. We're going to hear other voices outside the mainstream box. Famed ABC producer, author, and blogger Danny Schechter will lead off the charge. He claims the financial system is riddled with fraud. We'll hear snippets from insider business bears Ian Gordon and Meredith Whitney, the one-woman force who broke out the truth about Bear Stearns. Whitney ends up advocating, if you can believe it, relocalization, and warning you that credit cards you've counted on may go bye-bye. Lots to learn there. Our mystery guest is Ilargi from the popular financial blog The Automatic Earth. And we have an earthquake from within the Obama administration itself. Elizabeth Warren heads a congressional panel overseeing the TARP funds. She questions the whole program, wondering if Tim Geithner's Treasury may have any real strategy. Based on experience of other countries, the U.S. may be going the wrong way down a one-way street. Warren sounds like a mother to America as she explains this whole crisis. You'll hear the best of that. We may get time to investigate the hundreds of trillions of dollars that U.S. banks claim they have. Do the top five banks really have five times the total top production of the world in their vaults, just when most pundits and economists agree that these same banks are insolvent? So let's get going. Here's my interview with Danny, the news dissector.
Overnight, global markets have taken a huge hit. London, Paris, Frankfurt.
Did ordinary people cause this financial crisis? I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock, and we have a seasoned professional to help us through this. Daniel Schechter is an award-winning journalist, author, and filmmaker. From his roots as the news dissector at WBCN Radio Boston, through his Emmy Award-winning productions for ABC TV's 2020, Danny has a record of fighting for those hurt by the system. Currently, he's executive editor of MediaChannel.org, with a withering daily blog, I might add, and author of the new book, Plunder. Danny, thank you for joining us today.
Hey, my pleasure.
Well, let's start with plunder. That usually involves violent gangs and innocent victims. Does that apply to America today?
Well, what I've come to see, and what I'm arguing, what I'm making a film about, what I've written a book about, what I write about every day, is the origins of this financial crisis and how crime played a big role in it. In other words, we all know that the housing boom turned into a housing bust, that a lot of money was invested in homes and people were given mortgages who couldn't afford the mortgages. And there's a tendency, you know, to sort of blame everyone. You know, it was greed on the one hand, and on the other hand, it was irresponsible borrowers, and that sums it all up. Without any real examination of the forces at work here, essentially, that deliberately came up with a scam of trying to get poorer people into homes so that they could then resell the mortgages, knowing full well that these people couldn't afford to sustain those homes and would in fact default on their mortgages, leading to the foreclosure crisis we have in America today, which is due to get worse this month, but it's, you know, around 10 million homes as it is right now. So we have a situation where a scheme developed, you know, using subprime lending, which was actually designed as a reform to help people who weren't able to get access to credit because of predatory practices in the past and because of racial discrimination and like, and to give them an opportunity to get loans. But what happened is that people began to be targeted and driven into subprime lending, which has a very high fee structure. So you're actually paying more for the loan than you would for a regular loan. 50% of the people who actually took out subprime lending loans were eligible for prime loans. So this was they were steered in this direction by a real estate industry at the local level, which was working in cahoots with big banks and big entities on Wall Street to then resell these mortgages, securitize them, slice and dice them, put them into these packages, or bundles, as they were called, into CDOs, collateralized debt obligations, structured investment vehicles, a lot of things that are kind of complicated, and then resell them overseas often. And they were making billions of dollars. When we find out that there are several hundred thousand people in finance who are now out of work, you get a sense of how big this industry was and how much money it was making. Of course, at a certain point, it's quite clear that when people can't afford to pay back, they're going to start, basically defaulting on their mortgages and defaulting on other loans, and that's what's happened right now. So we have a nation deeply in debt on the one hand. We have a group of banks and insurance companies and others who have actually become insolvent because of their practices of, extracting large amounts of money, which then went into high salaries and bonuses and the like. And we have a banking system tottering, which is being revived, if you will, by the federal government, pumping billions of dollars into it, seemingly with no end in sight. And so, you have a lending frozen. Basically, you have banks that are not functioning or functional. You have economic, stagnation. You have unemployment up to potentially 20%, depending on how you count it, whether you count people looking for work, whether you count people who are underemployed as well as people who are unemployed, who are seeking assistance, and what have you. There's a lot of ways to factor, an analysis of what factors you put into it. But the net effect is that there's economic stagnation, a very deep recession, if not a depression, although nobody wants to call it a depression. You'll recall that the federal agency responsible for determining whether or not there was a recession only determined officially that there was a recession a year after it began. That's the National Economic Bureau of Research. So, you have a situation here where the information about what's happening, the transparency, the disclosure is hardly adequate. And so we don't even know now how much money has been lost, how much money has been injected into the system, how much money will be injected to try to keep this system afloat. We have a very deep economic problem here, and it's not something that can be solved overnight. In fact, waving a magic wand at it, trying to cut interest rates, trying to put capital into banks, all these things have been tried and so far have not been successful in getting the economy moving again, getting recovery going. So that's the situation right now. With the United States government now, maybe depending on who you read and who you believe, pumping in or having obligations for $7 trillion with a potential $150 trillion either lost or at risk. So, this is the numbers here are extraordinary. Nobody really can keep up with it. And, so any sign, any glimmer of hope is sort of seized upon, as President Obama did the other day, to say, oh, there are signs of recovery. Things look good. There's an upturn. But the people I'm reading, the financial bloggers, the people who are in the Wall Street world and who are honest about what's going on are extremely pessimistic. That's why the New York Times reported today that a lot of Wall Street people are leaving the industry, becoming entrepreneurs or doing something else, because they don't have much confidence that the system can be saved. And that's where we are right now. It's not a pretty picture.
And it's so odd, because every time corporations fire tens of thousands more people, the stock market actually goes up. It seems perverse in that way.
Well, that's true. And part of that is, because there's a cost cutting going on here. This is a system that's totally out of whack. The idea that individual investors control the stock market is an illusion. It's really controlled by the movement of large amounts of investment by various firms, what are called the quants, who are operating on algorithms and formulas, when to buy and when to sell. And so there's a lot of manipulation within the market that is not really reported on very well. What we hear about is the market went up, the market went down, as if that explains anything. And that's the kind of financial reporting we've gotten. In my book, Plunder, I look at three different phenomena. One, you know, the role of the Wall Street firms. And here I find basically a cartel of people who supposedly were competitive but were actually collaborating with each other, buying off the rating agencies who were certifying these subprime lending bundles as AAA investments, and engaging in, you know, extremely corrupt practices. Then we have the regulators who are not paying attention at all, asleep at the switch. And then we have the media, the third part of my book, which was not warning us about any of this and not covering it, in part because between 2002 and 2007, some $3 billion was put into the Internet, into the television and radio, commercials by dodgy lenders and credit card companies. So this reflects a deeper problem in America, which is called financialization. The financial institutions became the dominant players in our economy. So instead of money being used to finance production, finance factories, finance jobs, money was being made on money by investing in paper of various kinds, asset-backed securities, and et cetera, and so forth, and all these flim-flam derivative products and credit default swaps and all this other stuff, where they were basically gambling. They had turned the stock market into a casino. And, of course, you know, there are people who go to the casino and make money, but most people lose.
Well, you know, the Atlantic Monthly has an article coming out in May called The Quiet Coup, and it's by a former chief economist of the IMF, the Monetary Fund, Simon Johnson. And he says the American financial oligarchy has, in some sense, taken over the U.S. government. What's your take on that?
I think it's right. You know, your listeners might want to check out his work. He has a website called The Baseline Scenario. And in this, he not only has his own essays and articles, but also an explanation of the financial crisis for beginners, baselinescenario.com. It's something worth checking out. I think he's a very thoughtful and writer. He's not compromised. He's not out there trying to sell. He's trying to tell. And that's very different from a lot of the financial journalists who seem to be wearing two hats. On the one hand, in order to get access to Wall Street people and all the rest of it, they often do, you know, fawning portraits of, you know, the CEO of the week kind of thing, and are not critical in their approach. And on the other hand, you have people like Johnson, who's a academic now at MIT and a blogger, and he's doing something excellent, you know, excellent analysis. There's another website your folks might want to check out called Naked Capitalism, another source of analysis and information that's not compromised. The third is something called ML-implode.com, and that's really taking monitoring all the implosions we've had in the financial industry and the real estate industry. So there are sources of information out there, but they don't seem to be working their way into the mainstream media, which was very late to covering this. Everybody's covering it now. They can't ignore it. And, you know, the contradictions are so blatant, you know, with not only the massive bonuses that we've been hearing about and have been triggering so much anger on people's part, but also, you know, all the other, you know, flim-flam fraudulent tactics. I mean, the FBI says mortgage fraud in America is epidemic, okay, pervasive. You know, of course, we know the Bernie Madoff story, $65 billion Ponzi scheme by one guy, unbelievable. But there are many, many others who are not only involved with him, but who have yet to be indicted. So, you know, we need a jail out as well as a bailout here.
Well, you know, I read the financial papers or I watch corporate video. There's so little sign of compassion for the millions of lives being wrecked by this fiasco. There's occasionally they go into, you know, a tent city, but it's a kind of voyeurism. Maybe it's even a warning to frighten workers into accepting more pay cuts. I don't know. Do you think that the net is going to do a better job, places like YouTube and media channels?
There are some people trying to, but, you know, it's difficult in part, first of all, because of the failure of disclosure and you know, transparency on the part of these firms. For the one, secondly, a lot of journalists, a lot of people, even progressives, are intimidated, you know, by the finance world. They feel like you have to be an expert. You need a PhD in economics to write about it. Otherwise, your credibility can be challenged. They would prefer to to just go after bad guys, you know, go after Bill O'Reilly on Fox News, go after George Bush, go after George Bush again, go after George Bush a third time. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I mean, that's been characteristic of a lot more individual analysis than institutional analysis. And that's one of the problems we find across the spectrum in, you know, in journalism. As far as, you know, the suffering of people, it's somehow invisible. You know, today, for example, the New York Times reported on page one that states across the country are cutting back on all sorts of help for the most vulnerable people, senior citizens. There's been an epidemic of child abuse that's taking place as parents who are anxious about the loss of their jobs, the loss of their homes, are taking it out on their kids. So you have, this is a social crisis, no longer just a financial crisis. It affects everybody across the spectrum, and it's going to get more serious. And that's what I think we have to really look at and try to respond to. Yesterday in New York and in 60 cities across America, a new force called the New Way Forward emerged. I write about it in my blog on mediachannel.org, the News Dissector blog, about this demonstration that took place yesterday in New York, but it was also taking place in 60 other cities where they're calling for the nationalization of banks. They're challenging the Obama economic policy. They're trying to get it to go deeper and more fundamental in terms of restructuring our economy. In other words, the goal here should not be to pump money in to revive the very economy that was completely corrupt and predatory to begin with. You know, we need more vision here, you know, deeper structural changes, less consolidation of power and fewer hands, which is what we've seen. So yesterday in New York, I mean, it was in pouring rain, but, you know, people turned out, apparently as a result of this A New Way Forward website that they've created, 9,000 people signed up in 1 month and took part in protests in 70 cities or 60 cities. In New York, it was pouring in Union Square. I mean, they kept trying to create a dry area by putting up plastic sheets. They kept getting, you know, the plastic sheets just got blown away by the rain. So the whole demonstration moved into the lobby of a nearby bank, the Bank of America, and it was an actual protest inside the bank, you know, by the ATM machines. The police finally came and threw everybody out. But, you know, it was a tremendously spirited thing, and it was really nice to see this because the left, progressive, anti-war, all these other movements have not really understood this crisis. They've been in denial about it. They haven't really challenged the banks. They jump on like whatever's, you know, whatever the Obama administration may be saying or doing, but they don't go beyond it. And I think finally there's a force here, and this guy Simon Johnson, in a baseline scenario, is supporting it, as are many other people, including myself, on mediachannel.org.
Well, you know, Danny, in a recent business interview here in Canada, the financial analyst Meredith Whitney warned that the next impact on the average person might be just losing their credit cards. And so many families assume that Visa or MasterCard is going to be their real savings account. They'll use it if they get laid off or something, but it may not be there. Do you think the middle class is in for a rude shock when it comes to the way debt is?
I did a film called In Debt We Trust. You can look it up at indebtwetrust.com. This was a film that I started working on in 2005. It came out in 2006, warning of this credit crisis, warning of the way in which credit cards were transferring wealth from middle-class America to the richest institutions in America. And, you know, because we're talking about interest that goes up to 36%, which used to be considered usury until all the laws against usury were abolished by lobbying, after lobbying by the credit card companies and the banks. And, of course, bankruptcy laws were also made more difficult. So you have a situation where people are dependent on credit cards. 31 million families in America have maxed out on their cards. A lot of people have taken out equity loans, have found that the banks just stop the line of credit. Boom, period. It happened to me. It's happened to many other people. No explanation, no discussion. So, you know, the credit card situation, many people have 10 credit cards, you know, or more. this whole situation is being tightened up significantly by the banks. Of course, they're the ones who had been, basically marketing credit cards to people, even people who had been bankrupt. You know, they were getting, solicitations for credit cards and the like. I was just got one for the black card on MasterCard. The black card is like, it costs $500 a year to get it, but you get all these extra perks and free gifts and concierge services and all the rest. It's a real luxury card. I expose this in my film, In Debt We Trust. So, I mean, we all need to do a better job at educating ourselves about what's really going on. You can't just accept, TV pundits or financial channels. You have to try to get diverse information from many sources. I think my book, Plunder, which is available at Amazon.com, is a good introduction, if only because, even though I went to the London School of Economics, I went to the Cornell University School of Labor Relations, I have some economic background here. I did the first story on the SNL crisis on ABC News years ago. I approach this not as an expert, but as an ordinary person, try to explain what's going on in understandable language. And, it also warned about what was coming down. The book came out a week before Lehman Brothers collapsed. Now Bloomberg News reported this weekend that there's something called Lehman Shaku, which is a term in Japanese for the Lehman Shock. That's some 460,000 people out of work in Japan alone as a consequence. So, the ripple effect of this is dramatic, and everyone is experiencing it. The problem is that it's a slow motion crisis. As a result, everything doesn't all happen at once, and so people can justify a sense of denial, a sense that, this is not affecting me, I'm okay. But, none of us are okay, because when these big financial institutions go down, they bring a lot down with them.
Yeah, well, I'm trying to learn about finance myself, and I'm looking for those that will impact my listeners the most. Do you have suggestions of where I should be looking as this snowball seems to roll towards
the
flames?
Well, I've given you a couple of news sites of financial analysis, which I think are pretty good. The Naked Capitalism site or the Baseline Scenario site. But, some people say take your money out of the bank. Some people say don't do that, because what are you going to do with it? You know what I mean? There's a lot of debate about what should be done, what can be done. I'm not a financial advisor. I'm not somebody to tell other people what to do with their money. I'm not that good with my own money, to be honest with you, But I do think that we have to learn more about this. What we need is more cooperative institutions, credit unions, for example, and barter exchanges, ways to save money, ways to get what we need without becoming mindless consumers and getting deeper in debt. Obviously, people are getting that message. In fact, use of credit cards have gone down, and shopping is going down, and this is having the effect also of making the whole recession worse. So you have Obama caught in the squeeze. On the one hand, he wants to build confidence. He wants to tell people everything's going to be okay. On the other hand, he's trying to tighten the rules and regulations on the financial institutions that caused this crisis, and some of them are pushing back. There was an article over the weekend about, banks who feel that the rules are too strict. In other words, they took all this money from the government, and now the government is saying if you took the money, you can't give out big bonuses, you can't give out outrageous executive compensation. So they're saying, well, that's terrible, because you are imposing, on our freedom. And then you have the right wing in America, which is going ballistic here, believing that socialism has arrived, that Obama has some secret agenda. First it was a Muslim agenda, then it was who knows what, now it's a socialist agenda. And so you have the right wing basically, Obama was saying hope, and they're saying nope. You know, they're saying, no, you know, we're not going to support anything. And, you know, the hoping in a sense that the system will collapse so they can then say, see, I told you so. So we're in a sort of no-win, very polarized environment where, you know, it's pretty scary, actually, because you don't know what's going to happen.
And almost anything could happen. We've been talking with Daniel Schechter, and he's with MediaChannel.org. He's just a really well-known person all over the media and the author of the new book, Plunder. It's obviously need-to-know information.
Let me give my email, if I could, Danny@MediaChannel.org, if any of your listeners want to write to me. And, of course, the blog is newsdissector.com. It's available on mediachannel.org as well. And, you know, I'm doing a film on my book, Plunder. Plunder is at amazon.com. So, you know, you can follow up on this, and I'd be happy to hear from any of your listeners who have other questions.
Well, that's just such a generous offer, and I know people will take you up on it. This is Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock, and Danny, thank you so much for your lifetime of contributions.
Thank you very much for having me on.
This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith. It's free and commercial-free. Find all our past programs at ecoshock.org. How bad is it? 1 in 9 U.S. homes is empty. Hugely overbuilt, at great cost to our forests and mines, the phony construction bubble poured more greenhouse gases into the atmosphere and built out into farmland for gas-guzzling supercommutes, not to mention all the hopes, of millions of Americans dashed. As James Howard Kunstler has been saying for years, the suburban experiment based on cheap oil and throwaway values was a failure of civilization. And don't forget Kunstler's weekly blog. It's called Cluster Beep Nation. It's the saddest, funniest writing out there, coming up every Monday morning. Find that link in our Radio EcoShock show blog.
Spoon-feeding capital to broken institutions will not bring them back to life, nor will indulging in fantasies of reviving the real estate bubble. Having the government buy bad assets will either fully reveal the weakness of bank balance sheets if done at fair prices, or if done at inflated prices, will simply be a way of hiding the largest regressive wealth transfer in U.S. history. A wealth transfer that will still not be big enough to revive the sickest big banks.
That was Damon Silvers. He's the sub-chair of the committee that's reviewing the TARP program for the U.S. Congress. Are you sick of the Geithner-Summers axis handing out your billions to the banksters? It's really just a continuation of the George Bush TARP plan cooked up by former Goldman Sachs head turned Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson. Not everybody in government is in love with the troubled assets relief plan. Congress appointed a panel to review TARP, and the results have rocked Washington's boat. Congressional Oversight Panel Chair Elizabeth Warren openly questions whether the Treasury strategy is working, or if they have a strategy at all. She suggests there are other options, including firing the heads of the big insolvent banks and breaking them up. Well, that's revolutionary talk. Let's hear this government revolutionary, Elizabeth Warren, describing how this whole mess got going.
My name is Elizabeth Warren, and I'm the chair of the Congressional Oversight Panel. I'm here to introduce our fourth monthly report, which is titled Foreclosure Crisis, Working Toward a Solution. Okay, let's get it right out front. Did some people do some really stupid things, buying houses they couldn't possibly afford and taking on mortgages that they couldn't pay? Yes. Yes. And some people weren't so bad. They were just a little too optimistic when they heard real estate agents and neighbors say housing prices always go up. And some people were solid, good people who already owned their homes and got talked into refinancing perfectly good mortgages into really risky products. And some people got cheated, sold mortgages that were so loaded with tricks and traps that they were destined to explode and take the family with them. So there it is, the good, the bad, and the ugly. Now we have a full-blown crisis. Foreclosures are mounting, and they drag down housing values and leave vacant homes and uncollected taxes. Every one of them is like a house on fire on your street, threatening your house and threatening your neighborhood. Defaulted mortgages also threaten the banking system and the stock market. So they threaten your retirement account, your job, your small business, your economy, and your future. So we can sit around and we can try to figure out who deserves help and who doesn't, who smoked in bed and who got struck by lightning, while we watch our whole country burn down. Or we can try to fix it. Today, some of our biggest banks are on life support because of investments in these toxic mortgages. From the start, Treasury's use of the Troubled Asset Relief Program, or TARP, has mainly focused on stabilizing the financial institutions that lie at the top of the economic pyramid. But the members of the oversight panel believe that we won't be able to pull ourselves out of this recession and end the financial crisis without a plan to address the foreclosure problems that helped get us into this mess. We begin our report with the story of how the housing bubble started. We explain how the mortgage market changed from a solid, low-profit, low-risk financial service into a high-profit, high-cost, high-risk industry that inflated the housing market, made a lot of people really rich, and has now exploded into flames, taking down millions of families and our whole economy. One in five with a mortgage now owes more on the house than it's worth. And for some, just one small bump and they end up walking away. You can read our full report, or just the summary, and offer us your own thoughts at the cop.senate.gov. That's cop.senate.gov.
That was COP Chair Elizabeth Warren speaking on March 9, 2009. Doesn't she sound like your mother explaining how your allowance works? I like Warren. Find her original videos at cop.senate.gov. Here are a couple of quick clips from Elizabeth Warren in her April 19th COP report, which shook the Capitol. She dares to say the Treasury could be doing things much differently.
Basically, there are three choices available to policymakers. Liquidation, close down the bad banks. Receivership or conservatorship, reshape those banks in place. And subsidization, provide them with money to get them through the rough times. A good example of the first option, liquidation, comes from the savings and loan crisis in the 1980s. The government shut down unhealthy financial institutions by transferring depositors to another bank, selling off assets, writing down some debt, firing the managers, and wiping out the investors. Depositors did fine, but investors and managers took a real hit. Not surprisingly, liquidation can be politically difficult, and management of weak banks really don't like it. It is possible that liquidation could destabilize markets if it came as a surprise or was not well explained. But liquidation has the benefits of avoiding the uncertainty and open-ended commitment that accompany ongoing subsidies. Because it gives a clear and decisive message about the health of the banks and the willingness of the government to shut down the bad ones, it may speed up recovery. The second policy option is a government reorganization or conservatorship. Two examples are Continental Illinois in the U.S. in the 1980s and the financial crisis in Sweden in the 1990s. The failed managers are replaced, bad assets are taken off the books, and parts of the business may be spun off. Depositors and some bondholders are protected, and the bank may emerge with the same name, but a much healthier balance sheet. This option makes it clear what the newly cleaned up bank is really worth, so it can usually attract new investors. But the reorganization can be tough for governments to manage, and there's a risk that a bank run by the government could be hit with political pressure. To avoid these problems, there's a real value in returning the banks to private hands quickly. The third option is government subsidies for troubled institutions, which was the approach used in Japan during that country's lost decade. Subsidies may be direct by providing banks with money, or capital infusions in banker lingo. Subsidies may also be indirect by purchasing bad loans off the books at inflated prices. Giving subsidies can obscure the real value of the assets. Knowing the government will add taxpayer money to any purchase can make it really hard for markets to function normally. Subsidies also carry a risk that they will be open-ended, propping up insolvent banks and delaying economic recovery. But subsidies may help banks get through tough economic times until growth begins again. If a crisis is short, that may be all that's needed. It is possible, however, that Treasury's approach fails to acknowledge the depth of the current crisis. The economy may not come roaring back, and the big profits that propped up the banks during the housing boom may not return. For some, that means it is necessary to consider alternate approaches.
You are listening to Radio EcoShock as we thrash through this financial crisis. The next part is not for the faint of heart, but I think you need to know how bad this might get and plan accordingly. Our next speaker suggests this depression, and that is what we have here, a depression, might last until 2020. And as financial insiders, they also suggest that the biggest American banks will fail, fall, and they should. We'll draw from an excellent TV special in a program called The Close on Canada's business news network, BNN. Four of the most famous market pessimists, the so-called bears, well, they appeared at a $3,000 seat forum in Toronto. Then each went on The Close. The program was called Bear Attack, and you can find it at the BNN site, bnn.ca, or link directly via my show blog. Yes, Nouriel Roubini spoke, and you can find him everywhere. I want to focus on two other guests, the now-famous analyst Meredith Whitney and the longtime pessimist and gold bug Ian Gordon of the Long Wave Group. Gordon has been calling for a massive stock correction, and he means a big drop, since the year 2000. How bad will it get? Here is Ian Gordon's view from the BNN show.
Well, you know, the number that I've sort of selected as the bottom of the bear market is, again, based on the number of the bear market reached in 1932, between 29 and 32. And that was a 90% drop from the peak. Stocks dropped 90%. So if we were to do the same today, the Dow, if taking the 2000 top, which I argue is the top of the Dow, and we had the Greenspan top later on, but if we take the 11,750, we're looking at something like 1,200 on the Dow for the bottom. And if we take the 14,200, we're looking at 1,400 for the bottom. I'm going a little worse and saying that it's probably going to 1,000 on the bottom. So only because the bull market was much bigger between 1982 and 2000 than the bull market between 21 and 29. Much, much bigger, about three times the size. Also, in the 21-29 bull market, the United States was a massive creditor nation with a massively growing economy. It really sold that everything was really very strong for the United States. Its only thing that happened was the banking system collapsed in the 30s. And so I think this time around, the U.S. is the world's largest debtor nation, and it has a very massively declining manufacturing base. So I'm picking on 1,000 also because 1,000 was a resistance point in the Dow from 1966 until 1983. The Dow never got beyond 1,000, so that's the number that I've selected. The Vancouver newspaper did do an article in 2004 when I was talking about the coming real estate bust. And he did research a house that sold in Vancouver in 1929 for $75,000, and that same house in 1939 sold for $7,500. So, you know, using that just a very one specific example, we're going to see significant losses. Even if we go back to the price, real estate price in the United States of in the mid-90s, that would be a 66% drop from the peak, real estate price peak. Very tough. My prognosis is the depression doesn't end until 2020. So it's going to be very, very tough. And the worst thing to have going into this era is to have a lot of debt. Families that have a lot of debt are going to find that very, very difficult.
That was a collection of predictions by Ian Gordon of the Long Wave Group. Let's imagine the stock market will drop at least below the 5,000 mark, and I think it'll go way below that. Even the cautious CIBC Bank in Canada just predicted another big market slide. How soon could this hit us? There are two major schools among these pessimists. The first is predicting a big economic hit in May or June, or at least by this summer. The second school fears it will take a lot longer, a death by 1,000 cuts, if Wall Street and the Obama magicians dance as long as they can, putting it all off. Meredith Whitney has put out a report called The Agony of Incrementalism. Everybody stalls by admitting bad debt just a little at a time. We'll hear that in the following clips from The Bear Attack, plus her warnings about the credit you think you have.
Specific to the banks, you know, the banks are sitting on trillions of dollars of overvalued assets, loans that were underwritten with bad math. And as an example, you have $7 trillion of mortgages that were underwritten with sub 6% unemployment assumptions, which were written with originally underwritten with the idea that home prices would never go down because, after all, they hadn't since the Great Depression. So now, in unison, the banks are expecting around 30% peak-to-trough declines. Well, we're already at 30% for the Case-Shiller 10-city index. I'm estimating we'll go to 50. So we got a ways to go. Whether they're insolvent or not, they just aren't going to earn that much over the next couple of years. You have a rate of upside down or people that own more than they own. You know, it's not justifiable to keep people as homeowners when they really don't own anything in their home. It's not so much the defaults, but it's really a contraction of liquidity. So my big worry, you're absolutely right, is the credit card issue, because it has gotten so... U.S. consumers, and I would say consumers around the globe, have gotten so dependent, but specifically U.S. consumers with their relationship with credit. They use credit and their credit lines as a cash flow management vehicle. And you could say, no, that couldn't be possibly true because everyone I know pays down every month. Well, in fact, 90% of Americans that have credit cards revolve one time during the year, at least one time during the year.
90%.
And so over 45% revolve every month. And so people clearly use those as a cash flow management vehicle. And let's use a tangible example. If you have a $10,000 line and you're using $2,000 on a regular basis, you think $8,000 is my what if fund. What if I lose a job? What if my wife loses a job? What if a kid gets sick or a dog gets sick or a kid needs braces? Or you can imagine I have this extra stash of money that I can use. Well, that's already being cut. The $500 trillion of credit card lines were cut in the fourth quarter alone. And I think that number is going to, in aggregate, go to close to $2.7 trillion. That means 55% of all credit card lines in the U.S. will be cut from the peak. And what that means is that everyone probably literally got a pay cut and now is getting a cut in terms of credit. And that psychologically has a very damning effect on your willingness to go out and spend. And then for a smaller segment, it has a very pronounced effect on your ability to go out and spend, because typically the higher end consumer is going to have the most lines unused, and the lower end consumer is going to be living paycheck to paycheck and managing through that card. 30% of Americans have no access to credit. So it's you got to remember it. So the guys who are really stretched are going to be a smaller group. But from a slowdown in commerce, it's material.
You know, one thing I just want to connect the dots here, because I had seen you said this earlier, but the reason that the banks are cutting back these credit lines is because they have to put up capital to guarantee, regulatory capital to guarantee that people do use those credit lines. So the banks are pulling that back, which in turn is the reason why that's hurting consumers.
Well, that's one reason. The biggest reason is risk aversion. So as is said in any economic downturn, the people that you want to lend to don't want to borrow, and the people that you don't want to lend to want to borrow. You're sitting on, capital structures that are based on, sand, because the assets keep devaluing. And I don't see anything that... they start out with such high premiums and bad math. I don't see anything reversing that in the near term.
Even your last report I saw was titled "The Agony of Incrementalism." So, I mean, you're obviously it's a death of a thousand cuts we're seeing in the banks right now.
Well, you're just correcting bad math on a slow basis over and over and over again. So you've seen, this was really with reserve provisioning, but also with CDO write-downs, right? So each quarter they're marking their loans to market. Each quarter they're catching up on the loans that they own, the reserves to those loans. So for example, each quarter they catch up on what peak to trough is going to be. Well, at the fourth quarter, they thought peak to trough would be, these are the banks, thought peak to trough would be 31%. This is the peak to trough U.S. home prices. There are at 37%. So you get one more quarter of special reserves. Then you get to the next quarter of special reserves. So it's unfortunate that investors that get their hopes up that this is the bottom just get disappointed time and time and time after again. But I'm surprised that there's still such a willingness to give the banks these credit for like, this is the bottom, now it's time to enter. And I think that I think there's going to be a group of investors that's going to be tempted to get back in. I hope they don't.
Obviously, no longer a debt culture, the leverage culture gone to a large extent. So banking is going to be transformed, I guess, Meredith.
Well, banking will be transformed to what was. So local lenders are lending to local borrowers and know your customer. And that's it's going to take a while to get there. The government's not interested in getting there faster. They're interested in supporting the large banks. I understand why. But to get to a bottom, we've got to really get back to what was as soon as possible. So there are plenty of healthy banks in the United States. So that's the good news. The bad news is they command de minimis market share. So it would take, even for the medium-sized banks, them growing their originations by a factor of 8 to 10 times to equate to one of the top five originators, lenders. They need some help to do it. So they're guys that aren't even on the radar screen that want to lend in their areas, and I think we're going to come out of this in a very regional basis. So this is an environment that's become very centralized, very nationalized. I don't mean it in the way other people would mean nationalized.
But U.S. banks serving U.S. customers.
So I think we'll go back to local banks serving local customers.
That was Meredith Whitney appearing on BNN's The Close on April 7th, 2009. I encourage you to go to bnn.ca to watch the whole program. It's kind of an education in horror, or is that reality? The show is called Bear Attack. Regular listeners know I like to pass on at least one useful tip, something you can actually do about this thing. I think Whitney has given us two important clues. Number one, the central financial institutions are likely to fail. They will be succeeded by local institutions who know their customers. I deal with a solid local credit union. While all that sorts itself out, I have to recommend gathering some cash at home. Remember, as Meredith Whitney points out, you may think you have a credit card or a line of credit to bail you out of some special expense, or even a medical emergency or a housing crunch, and then find out it isn't there anymore. I mean, it even happened to Danny Schechter, and he's a big-time producer and author. His line of credit was cut, as he told us in our earlier interview. Every expert these days tells you not to rely on credit cards. Those days are ending. We will have to become our own banks for a while. Well, that's easy to say, but how? Until now, as we teeter here on the edge of some economic cliff, I advise people to scrimp and pay off all their bills. But if you are just tuning into this reality of this new depression, step one is to collect yourself some cash, and yes, stick it in a safe place in or near your home. The situation is so serious, so near, I think, that people who are very tight for money should just pay the minimum on all those bills and their Visa bills and such, and stick any extra into your own piggy bank and don't spend it. If you have a great income, great, pay off all the bills. If you are already feeling poor, pay yourself first. Everyone needs some cash because the credit game could be called off at any time. Even if you can only save $25 a week, do that. Aim for 3 months of living expenses. When you have that, plus a 3 month supply of food, then pay off all your bills as fast as you can. Meanwhile, be your own bank. I'm Alex Smith. This is Radio EcoShock, and it's a special on the economic crash. If you were just tuning in, we've heard from Danny Schechter of MediaChannel.org, from Elizabeth Warren in the government's panel reviewing TARP, and two market bears. Next, we get advice from one of those canny bloggers who knows the score and writes anonymously as Ilargi at a blog called The Automatic Earth. As incredible financial news washes in, Ilargi keeps a sanity I admire. I read his blog daily to get my bearings. Here is Ilargi in his first radio appearance. Many of us would rather stick pins in our eyes than wade through financial reports and the formerly boring world of banking. No more. Jobs and expectations are melting like ice cream in the sun. It looks like our savings and pensions could go next. To enter this distant world of high finance, we are joined by a well-known writer from the inside, a sane voice who's helped me understand. It's Ilargi from The Automatic Earth at blogspot.com. Welcome to Radio EcoShock.
All right.
There have been so many jaw-dropping financial news. The big giants turn out to be midgets without money sometimes. You seem to digest this into a focus. How do you cope?
I recently got an address from a company close to where I live that makes cheap wine. Cheap but good wine.
Well, we'll keep that in mind as one solution. Well, let me ask you a more direct question. Do you think there has been a financial coup of the United States government?
If that is so, then that goes back a long time. There has not been a recent coup of the United States government.
We've had banking families for a long time, and these are the same people, you feel?
Well, you know, you're getting into... I forbid people in the comment section of my website to talk about 9/11. Because there's no solution, there's no resolution to this kind of stuff. There's a lot of theories, a lot of whatever. And but you're never going to get anywhere. There's always going to be two people saying, I believe this, and the other says, I believe that. And we should go beyond what we believe. We should like focus on what we know, as hard enough as it is. And in finance, I think it's the same thing. You know, you can point to 1913 when the Federal Reserve was founded. You know, which is a thing that's surrounded by a lot of secrets and mystery and Jekyll Island and that kind of stuff. Or you can point to 1971 when Nixon got the U.S. of the gold standard. You know, which allowed the U.S. to print as much fiat paper money as they wanted. Those things are not recent. From your question, I would think that you are referring to something more recent.
Well, I think I'm generally agreeing with you, though, because it seems like, every time there's a Warren Commission or some kind of investigation, it never goes anywhere. The right people cover up the right things if they have to. So what should we be talking about when we're looking at this economic mess? What comes to the top of the heap in your perspective?
The first thing that pops into my mind is Obama's promise of transparency of government during his election campaign, which is not being fulfilled at all. I think that is very important because, you know, in times of plenty, when everybody's happy with their bread and circuses, those things are not so important. But when people get poorer, they want to know why they get poorer. You know, they, at a certain point, they demand to know. And I think they have a right to know when the government hands out trillions of dollars of taxpayers' money to banks. The people have a right to know why that is done and how it is done and who gets what and why they get it. And that is not happening at all.
No, it's not.
It's completely opaque, the whole thing.
Well, it's so opaque. I mean, just take this one little thing about derivatives. The controller of the currencies reported that the American banks have $200 trillion, that's with a T, trillion, in derivatives, and yet the whole world production is about $50 trillion, they figure, annually. It just seems like an insane fantasy to be talking about trillions or even quadrillions of dollars of wealth in this situation. How do you make sense of that?
The official word from the financial industry is that derivatives are zero-sum bets. You know, there's one loser and one winner, so you know there's nothing being destroyed or created. It's just like one guy loses and the other guy wins. But as we have been saying on our site for a long time, that is not completely true, because at a certain point you're going to have a party that cannot pay up if it loses a bet. And derivatives are just bets. You know, they're wagers. It's gambling. And that's all it is. I mean, AIG calls it insurance, but the difference between insurance and bets is very narrow. If one big party like AIG, and this is probably the reason why AIG has already gotten $200 billion in U.S. taxpayer money, if they cannot pay up anymore, then the whole derivatives world is so interconnected. Like, everybody got a bet with his neighbor and his neighbor and his neighbor and his neighbor and his neighbor. And if one of those neighbors goes bankrupt, then the whole thing starts falling down. Because, you know, there's neighbors all over the place who are losing bets.
Wow.
You know what I mean? You know what I mean? Like, this whole thing, it's such a complex web of bets that it's not realistic to say that this stuff will all even out in the end.
Yeah.
And that's where it gets dangerous. There are people who say that only 2% will go wrong, but 2% of $1 trillion is $10 trillion.
That's big money, isn't it?
And I think it'll be at least 10%, and then you're talking about $100 trillion.
Well, it's mostly involving just five big American banks. I mean, they have about $200 trillion, according to this report. Anyway, if you had to pick a problem other than that that might destabilize our stock markets or maybe even cause a panic, what would that be? Is there some signal that we should be watching for, in your opinion?
Well, there's a rally. There has been a sort of a rally recently. And I was reading Bill Bonner today, who has a website called Daily Reckoning, and he was saying that the only thing that means is that there's still a lot of suckers out there who need to be bled, or something like that, right? You know, people want to believe that it'll all be all right. You know, the Obama administration talks about green shoots that's nice spring language and that kind of stuff. But nothing has been solved. I mean, Wells Fargo last week announces a $3 billion profit. Well, I can give you a $3 billion profit 2 months after you give me $25 billion. I can do that. You can do that too, Alex. That's no problem. But nothing structurally has changed. The only thing that has changed is that a lot of your money has been given to all these financial institutions, and a lot of them will have great numbers.
Well, they've been making some money somehow, but meanwhile, we've got a few million people are going to lose their homes and a lot of big problems for the people at the street level. That's what makes it so hard to figure out is as soon as a big corporation announces they're firing 10,000 people, their stocks go up. So the stocks actually reflect hardship in the average person.
That's how the system works, man.
What? But eventually, the most profitable company would be one that has no employees at all, using that logic.
Yeah. If GM fires another 100,000 people, then, hey, we're doing better. But in the end, of course, you're not going to make any products anymore or provide any services anymore.
When we spoke just a little bit earlier, you were telling me about the purpose of your writing and how that differs from other blogs that might be out there on the net. Would you explain that to us again?
Well, what I was saying is the element of it, I guess you could call it a finance blog or an economics blog or both or whatever. Most popular finance blogs out there are run by people who come from the finance industry. I'm not saying that I'm not from the finance industry. I'm just saying that I keep that hidden. They're run by people from the finance industry, and they are most of the visitors are people who are investors and who visit because they want a stock tip or an investment tip. Whereas what Stone Lee and me do at the Automatic Earth is try and give people the information that will enable them to not lose money instead of gain money. Because I think a lot of people, we're in North America here, but the same thing happens in Europe, are going to lose a lot of the things that they thought they possessed. You know, if you look at what's happening to pension funds worldwide, that is a drama. That is so dramatic. If you have a home and it loses 40, 50% of its value, I mean, slowly and easily, and it'll be at least 80% before this whole thing bottoms. That homes in North America and in Western Europe can lose in value between brackets. And your pension funds, well, forget about ever getting a pension if you're under 50. It's not going to happen. So you have the loss of wealth and the loss of entitlement, and it'll be very dramatic for a lot of people.
What should we poor people do about this, if anything? Is there some way to prepare personally, do you think, for a possible meltdown of the economy?
Keep everything you still owe as close to yourself as possible, and that is not just about money, that's about people as well. You know, people are social animals, and the age of the nuclear family has tried to change that completely, where you have like a man and a woman, two kids per house, and on streets and streets and streets. We will need to live much closer to each other. Which is good, because, you know, the character we have, we're social animals, we're lions, we're not tigers. We're not solitary animals. But it'll be a lot of adapting, because, you know, we've gone through 50 years, where at least 50 years, where not only has the population, world population, grown enormously, but each individual also needs, between brackets, a lot more space for himself. The houses have gotten much bigger, the rooms have gotten much bigger at the same time when the population grows. So we cover so much more of the Earth's surface right now just for us. And that's all going to have to change. We won't be able to eat it anymore.
It's hard to eat from the pavement. Yeah. Well, as we're wrapping up here, is there something else you'd like to leave with our listeners?
Be good. Be cautious and keep on reading the Automatic Earth.
Okay, well, this is Alex Smith in a special Radio EcoShock report on our economic crisis. We've been talking with a source that I trust. I read this every day. It's Ilargi from The Automatic Earth at blogspot.com. You can find links to some of the stories we've discussed this week in my blog entry for April 16th, 2009 at ecoshock.org. Thank you so much for being with me.
You're welcome, man.
I'm Alex Smith. This has been Radio EcoShock, and I thank you for listening.